Thank you, Watt. I've been looking around for a new face myself, but I keep getting stuck with this one. My name is Paul Martin, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad and grateful to be here, sober this afternoon. The first time I've been to meetings in Texas through the years, and I hadn't been in Texas for some time. And I was over in Odessa in 65, and then at Brownwood last year, and here this month, and I was mentioning to Bob this morning that I've done a lot of traveling since I've been sober in AA, and I've met a lot of good alcoholics, good AA members, in a lot of different places. I've never been anywhere in my life in AA where I've met so many warm, very, very fine, pleasant people. And that's the truth. That's a pretty fair way to start off wherever you are, but it happens to be the truth here. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here today. I'm very grateful to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into AA in August of 1947 in Chicago, and I haven't had a drink since. And that's because AA works. It doesn't work, I find, on my terms. It does work on the terms of this program, these 12 steps, at Big Book. Tommy Breen mentioned something last night that I think is worth considering. I notice here that, looking at Tommy and Julian and Dave, I think finally there's a movement in AA that recognizes the very close correlation between no hair and high spiritual development. This has been a long time in developing, but I'm glad to see it. And this is the time when I would like to rededicate to Tommy Breen that famous old song, "Just because your head looks like a hubcap, don't think that you're a big wheel." I was very interested to learn that Tommy one time studied to be an artist, and he gave it up because he wanted to paint this beautiful model in the nude, and she wouldn't let him. She made him put on his bathrobe. That's my spiritual message for the day. I'm glad to see these bleeding deacon badges. I think that's wonderful because it recognizes something in AA that needs recognizing. Up in Chicago, we refer to them as hemorrhaging cardinals, but it means the same thing. And I got to admit, I do a little bleeding myself now and then. But I came into AA and I didn't really know what it was going to be about. I had gotten very dumb because I had decided to live in a way that was inevitably going to make me stupid. I had decided I was going to run things myself. For a while, it worked pretty well. Then it began to work less and less well, and finally it began to work very, very badly. But I kept thinking that if I can just arrange things properly, everything is going to be all right. And I would make all these arrangements, and then everything wouldn't quite be all right. But I had gotten stupider and stupider. I had a real belligerent ignorance when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat around and listened for a while, and my militant stupidity began to change a little bit. Because I began to see that these people knew some things that I did not know. Now, they knew something about staying sober, but as all of us find, there's much more in this program than just not drinking. And little by little, I began to see this. The only things I really know about living I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the place. This is the fellowship. This is the community, which has taught me not only how to stay sober, but has taught me something I never knew before. And that was how to live. I'm grateful to be sober, but if I could single out one other thing for which I am grateful in AA, it would be that in AA, for the first time in my life, I began to experience meaning. Things began to make sense. Before AA, nothing made any sense whatsoever. No matter if things were good, if they were bad, if they went my own way, if they went somebody else's way, it never was about anything. I seemed to be caught in some huge mistake, and I could never put things into focus. It was as if you're sitting in a movie, and the movie is out of focus, and I could never find the control that would bring meaning and sense to it. And as I sat in AA, and as I began to pay a little attention, and as my stupidity began to drop a little bit, I could see that these people knew something about living, which I did not know. I came into AA a fallen away atheist. I didn't believe in anything. And as I sat around, I began to hear them talk about God as they understood him. I was brought up in a very strict religious environment. I come from a family full of Lutheran ministers. And at a fairly early age, I got as far away from religion as I possibly could. And I used to think that was because the religion was so bad. I've changed my mind on that, and I think maybe that was because of me. I don't think really that I was an atheist, because I think that my lack of belief was not a lack of belief in God. I think it was a lack of belief in a mistaken idea of God. And I think this is what finally I did not believe in. I've come to believe in God, and I've come to believe that what I am supposed to be trying to do each day of my life is live as I should live. I don't think that God is some kind of a cosmic candy machine, and that if I find the right levers and the right combinations of prayers and things, I'll get what I want. I don't think that's what it's about at all. I don't think I'm here to arrange things so I get what I want. I think I'm here to start to learn how to accept what I should have, to live each day as I am supposed to live, to change, to remain flexible, to be willing to learn, to be able to learn. And there's a danger in being sober for a period of time, and I fall very, very badly prey to it. And that is to think that because in a period of years I have learned some things, that I know everything. And to think that because some things have worked for me and some people that I know, that I have no more to learn. This is a danger. It's nice to stick around and stay sober and learn some things. But running corollary with that, there is this real danger that I become inflexible and rigid in my views and become one of those hemorrhaging cardinals. And remember that what I'm here to do is to turn my will and life over to God each day, to ask for what I should have and accept it gratefully. There was once a diamond salesman who went to Las Vegas, and as he was sitting there drinking in a saloon one afternoon, he was talking to this attractive woman, and he was talking about his trade of diamond salesman, and he said, you know, it's amazing with all of these famous diamonds, like the Hope Diamond, the Kohinoor Diamond, and all of these, there's a curse that comes with them. And he looked over and he noticed that she had a very large, attractive diamond, and he commented on it, and she said, yeah. She said, that's the Plotkin Diamond. And he said, really, the Plotkin Diamond? I never heard of that. She said, and there's a curse that comes with this too. And he said, really, what's the curse? She said, Mr. Plotkin. Don't encourage me. I don't have to go home till tomorrow. I think it's interesting, too, what Tommy commented on last night, that there is only one promise in this program, and that's the promise of a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I think that these 12 steps are minimums, not maximums. These are minimums for me to work at, work through, and work toward, to little by little change and become the man that I am supposed to be. When I had been sober not too long in AA, I heard people say that I was responsible for my own troubles. And I thought, boy, that's certainly unfair. I mean, I'm to blame for all these terrible things that have happened. And I thought, that's pretty unfair, really. And I began to think and listen and pay attention, and I began to see that this was the gate to freedom. Because if I was the stoop that caused all the troubles, If I would change, I could stop causing the troubles. Wasn't that simple, and I had never figured that out before. Well, this was a simple conclusion, but then I began to see that changing was kind of a slow and difficult process. And as I continue to work, I continue to see that it's a slow process, and I have to work at it all of my life, because certainly sobriety is the beginning, not the end of this program. Sobriety is where it starts. It makes me able to work. Sobriety didn't make me honest. And I've got some pretty good evidence to that after I got sober. And it didn't take away my resentments. And it didn't take away my sloth and all of these things. Sobriety enabled me to start working at it. I've got a great fondness for the big book because, as Watt indicated, for about 7 years of my AA life, from 1951 to 1958, most of my AA living came out of the big book. I worked in northern Greenland up in Thule, which is 850 miles from the pole. I worked in Keflavik, Iceland. I worked in Point Barrow, Alaska. Some of the time we had meetings, and sometimes all the group was gone but me. And I used to read the book every day. And I continue to read the book regularly because in there I find me. In there I find what I would call real knowledge. I've been to 7 colleges in my life, and I've learned a few things, but I never learned anything with the guts and the validity that I have learned from the big book in Alcoholics Anonymous. Day after day, when I would be through working my 10 hours and it would be down about 50 below zero and my immense resentments would be seething, I would come in and read the big book. And something would change within me. And once again, I would see that if I'm wrong, or if I feel bad, it's not the weather and it ain't the Eskimos, it's me. And I better get to work on me. We worked 70 hours a week up in Thule. We worked an 8-month contract. And some of the time, I got a little disenchanted with my fellow citizens. I spent some time in prayer and meditation every day, but I used to read that book faithfully. We had one man up there who got a letter from his wife, and she said, "You know, it's wonderful. You're sending this money back home, and I just bought a new car for $3,000. I bought $1,000 worth of clothes, and I went to Miami for 6 weeks and spent $1,500. His wife wrote the letter, and he got it, and he started jumping up and down, and he penned a reply, and he said, "Here I am, 850 miles from the North Pole, working 70 hours a week so we can save some money. The wind blows 100 miles an hour sometimes. It's dark 24 hours a day in the winter. I'm working to save money, and you write me that you're spending all this money. What do you want me to do?" His wife wrote back and said, "Go farther north and send bigger checks." But I worked in Point Barrow for about a year and a half in 56 and 57. As Eve probably remembers, we had an unusual AA member there, Nick, whose father was Jewish and his mother was Eskimo. And Nick always used to say that he was unique to his knowledge in AA annals because he was the program's only Jew-skimo. And to my knowledge, Nick was correct. I didn't start out to be an alcoholic. I started out to be a clean-living American youth, and somewhere I got detoured. At breakfast this morning, they were talking about chitlings, and somebody wanted to know if I knew what they were. I sure do. Because I grew up down in southern Georgia, about 50 miles from the Okefenokee Swamp. And I used to go hunting there, and we hunt birds and alligators. I'm indebted to Walt Kelly and Pogo because he's publicized that area. Though he's got the animals talking, they never did that for me. It was only after I drank for a while that I ran into animals that could converse. But I grew up in a little quiet, kind of dull town. The town was so dull that if you took LSD, you would have seen visions of Lawrence Welk. Thank you for all those cards and letters. But Tommy was talking again last night, and I'm not getting into a race about how young I became an alcoholic, but I always, when I was very young, like 9 or 10, enjoyed the taste of beer and wine. I didn't get drunk, but if there was a little available around and I could snap up a gulp when nobody was looking, This is what I did. I can remember at the age of 12 picking the lock on my aunt's liquor closet to get her bottle of whiskey and take a drink or two and then put back some water so nobody would know that I had drunk any. Nobody ever told me that. That was an inward psychic gift, I guess. The first time I got drunk, I was 14 years old, and I loved it. Boy, this was wonderful. And I used to continue to drink because I liked what booze did for me. Suddenly, my life was transformed, and life was no longer out of focus. With the right amount of alcohol, everything got into focus. I had the control, and I was no longer involved in this cosmic mistake. Things made sense, and life was beautiful, and there were no real problems. I could forget that my life sober didn't have any meaning and didn't go anyplace. And I continued to drink. I was very interested in sports, and I worked hard at them and did fairly well. Rubbed all the hair off the top of my head doing wrestler's bridges. And I used to get drunk and get out of shape, and then I'd get back in shape in my sweatsuit. I'd plod around the track. I was either sweating, showering, drinking, or getting over a hangover. It's kind of a dreary routine. But I got out of high school. I went to a couple of colleges, and then I moved up in the Chicago area. I went into service. World War II was on. And I'd passed my physical for the Navy flight training program. I'd been doing some boxing for a club on the west side of Chicago. I got my nose broken for, I think, the third time, and had my septum reamed out. And I got drunk in the hospital. I got drunk. By this time, at the age of 20, I was starting to black out. There were some things that were changing. But I was having a tremendous time. This was really beautiful. Life had changed much for the better. I went into service and had a very undistinguished war record. I had pneumonia in the DTs in the Navy hospital. I went through basic and instruments at Corpus. I discovered a place called Beeville. That was a beautiful spot. I ran into something named Black Gold down in Corpus one time. I don't know if anybody else ever drank that, but if you're going to have a slip, stay away from it. But I continued to drink. I was in the hospital there in Pensacola with pneumonia and DTs going through operational. We had a man in there who'd been in the Navy for many years. I shared a room with him. He had ulcers. And they were going to x-ray him one morning to see how his stomach was, and they hadn't fed him for 18 hours before, and he was very, very hungry, whining and whimpering. So I threw him some cookies full of dates and nuts that I'd gotten from home, and he went up for his x-ray about 2 hours later. Well, I got out of the hospital shortly thereafter, and I asked him about 2 weeks later when I saw him on the street how his x-rays came out. He said, you know, that doctor told me I'm a real salt. I'm the only man he ever saw who had barnacles on his ulcers. By this time, I was what? I was 23. I was starting to have a little trouble. I'd say that DTs is an indication that you're not quite a normal social drinker. I had a very, very undistinguished war record. I destroyed 2 aircraft, both of which belonged to the U.S. Navy. A friend of mine pointed out that if I'd gotten 3 more, I would have been a Japanese ace. I continued to drink, and I thought, well, now, the war has ended. When I get away from these evil companions, things will change for the better. And I got out of service and discovered that I was my own evil companion. I got drunk over New Year's of 1945. I went up to Milwaukee. I started out for Cincinnati, and I wound up in Milwaukee by mistake. I was up there, and I was drunk for 3 days, and this was kind of a traumatic experience. As I mentioned over at Brownwood, I wound up with probably one of the worst-looking women in the Middle West. She was one of the Lee sisters. Her first name was Ugg. But she could have been named Playgirl of the Month by Popular Mechanics. But I still continued to drink because I didn't know what else to do. Life was not going too well drunk, but it was even worse sober. And I was not one of those quiet drunks. When I was sober, you might not hear a sound out of me, but when I was drinking, you knew that I was around. It's like that favorite story of mine about the man who was so fond of the color yellow. When he was small, he had a yellow scooter, then he got a yellow bicycle, he got a yellow convertible, and when he got married, why, he bought a yellow house with yellow furnishings, he wore yellow bathrobes and pajamas, and he'd been married about 2 years, and he came down with yellow jaundice. So his wife called the doctor came over and went in the bedroom. He came out about half an hour later, and the woman rushed up and said, "Doctor, can you save my husband?" Doctor said, "Save him? Hell, I can't even find him." Well, you had no trouble finding me when I was drinking. You knew that I was there. I continued to drink. I went on the wagon for 6 weeks in the early part of 46, and I got drunk, I got bitten by a dog, I had to take rabies shots, all sorts of strange things happened. Something had happened to my drinking now, and it wasn't working nearly as well as it had. I had a lot of problems making a living. I was very confused on the times when I would work. If I took more than half an hour for lunch, they had to retrain me. I was so punchy. Getting money in and out of the bank was difficult. Oh, I don't know why I ever put it in, because it never stayed long enough to get up to room temperature. I had a lot of stomach trouble. I used to get up every morning and take my gagging exercises. This was long before the advent of the isometric exercises, but I had stomach muscles like bands of steel. I very seldom drank in the morning because I was usually still drunk from the night before. And I used to get sick in the process. I had a great deal of willpower. You know, they say drunks don't have willpower. I had a tremendous amount, because I'd get sick in the middle of the night and I'd start throwing up, and I'd drink and I'd throw up and drink and throw up until I'd finally managed to continue to drink again. It was kind of like a Japanese tea ceremony without the finesse. But I would continue to work at it until I could keep some down and continue. Now, as far as enjoyment at that time is concerned, I had none. I would always like to remember how I felt at the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because the booze was done. The booze was gone as far as an out for me. What it had once done, it no longer would do. I drank because I could not stand life sober. I can remember waking up in the middle of the night, and it would be dark, and I wish that it would never get light. And I can remember waking up in the middle of the morning and remember something that had happened the night before, and I'd literally hide under the pillow, or going to bed drunk and not being able to go to sleep and have the whole room revolve and the skyrockets going off in my head. And I can remember being totally cut off, it seemed to me, from the human community, being completely alone. And I can look back on a lot of my drinking, and some of it was fun. Some of it was very, very enjoyable, and if it had not turned sour, I'd still be doing it. But when I came into AA, I came into AA because my escape no longer worked, because I had no answers whatsoever within myself. And I came to AA, and I was not at all sure that they'd have anything for me whatsoever. Not sure at all. But I knew that if they had anything that was any improvement at all over my life, I'd better try it. And I called AA in Chicago, and I went to a meeting the next day on a Sunday morning. I haven't had a drink since. I have not become real sane, and I have not become real honest. And not real useful, but a little more so of each of these than I was, I believe. There's a community in AA, or a communication, rather, which has nothing to do with words. It has something to do with what people are. And I'd gone on the wagon before AA. I'd been on the wagon for 3 months in early 1947, and I got drunk because I couldn't stand life sober. This was miserable. And I came into AA and started to stay sober and talk to these people, and I could see that they knew how to stay sober, but also they knew how to live. And I had never learned this. It says in the book, and this is real important to me, that our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And I believe that. I think that's what it's all about, that I change. I think the program is specific in what I have to do, very definite. I think it's a totality. I don't think the 24-hour program will work except as part of the entire program. I don't think it's possible for me to live one day at a time unless I've done everything possible to clear out the wreckage of the past. I think if I make a thorough effort to tailor myself to these steps, some very, very fine things happen. And one of them that I began to experience after a while was that my life began to make sense. I don't think that you can draw a one-to-one relationship between the physical law and the moral law. I think there are some parallels, though. I believe in the law of gravity, and I think if I jump out of the 10th story window here, I'm going to hurt myself. Because I think that the law of gravity is really there. And I think that if I try to break the moral laws of my society, I'm going to hurt myself too. And I think that this is why I was in such bad shape when I came to AA, that I had deliberately decided to live on the basis of my own self-will, do what I want to do and take what I want to take. And I think the inevitable result of that is that I cut myself off from the humanity of my society, that I become more and more stupid, more and more lonely, more and more depressed, and more fearful. And that's precisely what happened to me. And I think in order to straighten these things out, I have to live my way back into the human community by trying to follow these 12 steps as honestly as I can. I was talking with Bob this morning about honesty. This is something that I learned very slowly. I was very interested when I came into AA and I began to hear this talk about God. I thought, well, yeah, I'll pay some attention to this. I began to do a little praying, and I talked loudly about turning my will and life over to God as I understood him. And I did this, and about a year, I was in some very severe difficulty from a dishonest business deal. And I thought, well, I wonder if I've missed something in this program. I got very scared. I thought I might go to jail. I think that as a result of this, I did grow spiritually. But I did start paying some attention to some things besides this stupidity, which I was getting into, which was activity rather than action. I went to a lot of meetings, 5, 6, 7, 8 meetings a week. I completely ignored the action in the 12 steps and the need for my changing along these lines. Well, I looked then at the big book, and I saw that it had some real definite things for me to do. And I found that step one of these 12 steps defines the problem, and that this is a life that's unmanageable because of alcohol. And I found that step 12 showed me the goal, which is a spiritual awakening, and that if I would use those 10 steps in between, I'd start to change. And I started doing these things because I had quite an inducement at that point. And you do get help. You get it from strange places. I have a friend who's in the furniture business who was up in Grand Rapids, Michigan at a furniture convention a while back. And he was sitting there looking through a Gideon Bible, and in the flyleaf it said, if you're lonely, read the 23rd Psalm. So he turned to the 23rd Psalm and he glanced through it, and at the bottom of the page it said, if you're still lonely, call Mabel, and it gave a telephone number. I believe in the directions of these 12 steps, and I believe that they'll do for me just what the AA experience says. I had no answers when I came to AA, none at all. And I hope I can remember that, because I've learned from you. I've learned from this program, from the people in it, people who preceded me and those who have joined AA since I came in. I learned from each of you. And I can only continue to learn as I stay part of this human community and change myself to fit this program, because the only real things I know in my life I've learned in AA. I don't think that I have to be a thief or a murderer or a con man to completely waste my life. I think all I have to do is get so busy in trivia and unimportant things that I forget that I should be attempting each day to turn my will and life over to God, as step 3 says. And I think I can best do that by following the directions in the big book. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has followed this path, and I believe that. Because if I were flying in a plane at 20,000 feet and it caught on fire, and somebody rushed up to me with a chute and said, put this on and go out that hatch and save your life, What do you suppose I'd do? I don't think I'd start a discussion on the philosophy of parachute manufacture or the psychology of falling through space. And I don't think I'd go through the hatch without a chute hollering, "This is an individual program." I think I'd say, "Yes, sir, you bet," and out I'd go and hope it worked. As they say about the chutes, it don't mean a thing if you don't pull that string, and I think the same thing is true about these steps. They're not going to do anything for me unless I use them. And if I use them, they'll do all kinds of things. I think I'm supposed to live one day at a time without alcohol and without sleeping pills, without tranquilizers, without sedatives. I think I'm supposed to face reality through the strength of this program. I think that's all I need. I don't think I'm supposed to buy myself some tranquilized serenity with tranquilizers or sleeping pills, because I think to the degree that I use chemicals, they cut me off from reality and truth. If I'm uncomfortable, it means that I've got some work to do. And this is the workshop in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I heard about a cattleman one time who had a prize bull which had aged unfortunately rapidly and had lost interest in the cows on the ranch. And he was quite upset, and he went to a veterinarian. And he described the plight, and he said, "What should I do?" And the veterinarian gave him some pills, and he said, "Give one of these to the bull every 12 hours. And the rancher did for 3 days, and the bull recovered its exuberance. And he was recounting this to a friend about a week later, and the friend said, "That's very interesting. What's the name of those pills?" The rancher said, "I don't know, but they taste terrible." I'm still opposed to pills, however. I've changed my view a little bit on step three. When I first came in, I thought I was supposed to wait around for minute-by-minute instructions from the higher power. If I went to buy a package of cigarettes, I'd meditate at the counter, and the angel Gabriel would lean around and say, "Kent, with a micronite filter." I don't believe that anymore. I think I'm supposed to work these steps and use whatever intelligence I have. I found step four, when I took it, a kind of an interesting experience. I was looking at Dennis the Menace one time, and he was looking in the mirror, and he said, "Boy, if that wasn't me, I'd laugh." Well, I felt the same way when I took my fourth step. But it was only then, when I finally wrote out with pencil and paper as much truth as I could see about myself at that time, that I was able to go to work with the following steps. I think these steps are pretty much in order. I don't believe I can do something with a succeeding step until I have first gone to work with the step that precedes it. And this is what I found in step four. I found that as I began to see who, what, and where I was, I could make a move from there. If I want to take a trip from here to Dallas, I have to know some things. I have to know how to get from here to Dallas. But first of all, I have to know where I am. And that's what step four does for me. It shows me where I am. I took step five, and I didn't want to do it, but I knew I had to, or I'd get drunk. And I found it was remarkable. I'd been talking about it for a long time before I took it, with some authority, I might add. And I'd been right all the time, because when I took it, it did just what I always said that it would. I was interested in a quote I ran into of Wilson Meisner's one time on this business of self-knowledge and self-awareness. And Meisner said, "The cuckoo who is onto himself is halfway out of the clock," and by God, that's right. Once I began to see what was wrong, I had a chance to do something about it. The ego comes off in layers, and one of the things I discovered very belatedly in my AA life was that if I would continue to rework these steps, they would continue to do something for me. They would continue to change me. That the steps are the answer. It's like peeling off old wallpaper. As I continue to peel off a layer, I can see what's underneath it. And until I do this, I cannot see what's underneath it. I don't know where this program winds up, but I know that the higher I aim, the better my score will be. That well-known philosopher Phyllis Diller said that if you aim high, you won't shoot your foot off. And I agree with that. I think if I aim for 50%, I might hit 25. But if I aim for 100, I might hit 50. I don't know. But I think the higher I aim, the better my score will be. And I think that I used to say, I don't want to be a saint. Well, I'm not worried about being a saint anymore. But there's some character defects I'd really like to get rid of. I've had a tremendous problem with my ego, which sometimes seems to get worse instead of better. Great deal of trouble with pride, a great deal of trouble with resentments, a great deal of trouble with running things. I was mentioning at Brownwood last year. Every time I read that part in the big book which talks about the alcoholic as the stage master, directing everything and having everybody go through their paces and telling them what to say and what to do, this still hurts me. It really does. I find that since I quit trying to run all the AA in Chicago, I don't get quite as tired as I used to. I'm kind of grateful for that. But I'm willing to change things only finally when I begin to see what the trouble and the problem is. Not until then. A lot of people knew that there was something wrong with the way I drank long before I did. Long before I did. I always wanted to be sophisticated. And I'd put on my sophisticated suit, whichever one was out of hock, and I'd get a little money and I'd go to a bar and I'd drink and give this sophisticated conversation. Invariably, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm out in the alley throwing up. This was my version of sophistication. Always with all kinds of stupid answers, the authority. And I find that character sometimes still asserts himself. I find that continuing work with these steps is vital for me. And it took me quite a few years to figure that out. I thought you went through these steps once and you were all done, and I find that going back and periodically reworking 4 and 5 is extremely important, and reworking 8 and 9. Because I find a difference between relief and release. There is a difference between a momentary relief from alcohol and a release from the compulsion and obsession to drink. And there's a difference between a relief from depression and a complete release from it. And there's a difference between relief from anxiety or from resentment and a release from it. And I believe that these steps will let me follow the path which brings me closer and closer to release, not just from booze, but from the problems of living, because I don't really have much trouble staying sober these days. I have quite a bit of trouble on occasion living. And it's only through this fellowship that I get the strength to sustain me, and this is where it is. I believe in prayer, and I didn't used to believe in that, and I don't mean prayer as a device to get my own way. I mean prayer as a means to become what I should be. I spent a lot of time in gymnasiums building my muscles, and I found that as I would train for something, it would change me. And I find that as I train through prayer and meditation, praying just like the step says, just for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out, this changes me. And I start living myself into an understanding and awareness of living which I never had before. I find that a lot of my questions are not answered verbally, but I do these things in the program and suddenly I understand something which I never understood before. Because I believe this program changes our level of being. That if I start off here and go to work on the steps, little by little I will understand things which were blocked to me because I was not able to see them. If I stand on a mountainside 100 feet up, I can see a certain distance. If I go 500 feet, I can see farther. I can see things which were always there. But because I had not done the things which would enable me to see them, they were blocked off. And I feel the same way about steps 1 through 12, and prayer and meditation in particular. I think it enables me to live into the ability to follow God's will. Using the analogy of a river as God's will, through these steps, and particularly through step 11, I live my way into this river so that I naturally and maybe quietly go where I'm supposed to go. I'm not fighting anymore. And I'm not bumping into people and beating them up to do things my own way. And I think this is what these steps will do, if I'll just follow them. The Eskimos have an interesting word for reality. And the word is Mikesy. And it translates as the thing turned toward you. It's an interesting thought. And I think this is what finally happened to me when I came to AA. I had run out of the ability to evade and avoid and escape and hide from myself. No longer would the booze enable me to run. There was no place that I could hide any longer, and I came to AA. And through the help of all of you, I was given the strength and the grace to begin to see myself as I am, to begin to work from truth rather than sham and illusion. AA has given me many things. It's given me some very fine friends, an awareness of God as I understand Him, and the ability to live much of the time with some awareness of God. It's given me a lot more than I ever hoped for. It started off by giving me the understanding that I could not take one drink. As I became a part of it, it gave me the ability to stay away from that first drink. And further, as I continue to live in this fellowship, it gives me a way of life living that is so good, so meaningful, and so strong that I don't need to run anymore and booze and hide. I can live one day at a time on the basis of the truth and reality that I can understand. I can't do this alone. I can only do this with the help and the strength and the love of all of you in AA, because I think we're helped in AA by everybody, by people that we don't see and will never meet. I think that AA membership is a matter of living, how I'm doing within, not a matter of geography. I'm a member of AA wherever I am, as long as I am willing to live one day at a time in a way that entitles me to membership. I've got here all the things I really wanted and never could quite find before AA. And I believe that if I stay here and stick with all of you and listen and learn, I can begin to fulfill the purpose of this program, which is to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Thank you very much.